Greetings. I'm Pastor Mark Jarvis, and I welcome you to this 109th edition of Theological Dialogue. Now, that's a bit of a misnomer, of course, because it's hard to have a dialogue when there's nobody in the sanctuary with you. I am going to be lecturing today from an empty room. I've decided to go ahead and restart our theological instruction that we were doing when we were forced to leave it back in March. And I've decided to restart because I know that there are some of you who are interested in the subject and want to continue listening. And, well, frankly, you stuck at home, probably don't have anything else to do anyway. So I've decided to go ahead and continue the discussion. And you remember, when we left off, we were talking about the topic of eschatology. Eschatology, you remember, is the study of the end times. Now, the study of the eschaton. Now, when I say end times, of course, I don't mean just the end times. Eschatology is a study of everything that goes into what takes place at the end. It's a good way to say that eschatology is actually a way of processing all of human history so that it culminates somewhere in something. So how you understand the end times is going to be directly related to how you understand the flow of human history. So eschatology is a really big subject, and so we will continue our examination of it in this lesson. We started off, you remember, with a discussion of personal eschatology, because we all have one. We all have an end time. And so we needed to talk about things like the intermediate state. What does it mean to die and wait for the resurrection? So we needed to talk about that. And then once we did, we moved into a discussion of general eschatology, which is, of course, the way that the world itself, in general, is going to come to its end. And we spent some time talking about the various aspects of eschatology related to that in terms of what I call tent poles. Remember, I used the illustration out of Exodus 26, where God instructs the Israelites to construct the tabernacle, and they were to build this thing using tent poles, and on those tent poles were to be hung the curtains. Well, the tent poles in eschatology are the specific events through time that all of these eschatological systems accept as a part of human history, as an important part of human history. There'd be a tent pole, for example, at the creation of the world, and then at the fall of Adam, and then a tent pole at the coming of Christ, his first coming, including his death, burial, and resurrection, and ascension. And then another tent pole, of course, a future one, the return of Christ, followed by the judgment, and then, of course, the eternal state. And if you build a structure out of those tent poles, you then hang human history and all of the events between them on these tent poles like drapes, and you can push and pull them as you wish and fold them as you wish in terms of how you see that flow. And that's what the different eschatological systems do. So as part of that, we talked about the return of Christ being the first of those tent poles that we're looking towards. The coming of Jesus himself, the fact that he is coming, whether his return is imminent or not, and what it means for him to return, his second advent or his parousia as he returns to the earth. But then that moves us into a discussion of the millennium. The millennium is that thousand-year period of peace and prosperity upon the earth that is noted in Revelation 20, verses 1 to 6. The millennium is the event, if you will, the thousand-year period of time that most of these systems are constructed around and even named around. You think about the various eschatological systems like premillennialism and postmillennialism and amillennialism. They're all based on their understanding of the millennium. So, to talk about the events, we needed to talk about this thousand-year period of time. And as I said, each of the systems is going to treat the millennium differently. And so it's important for us to have an understanding of how each different system looks at the millennium. We started with the preterist position. You remember the preterist is the one who says that all of the prophecies regarding the return of Christ have already occurred. The preterist would deny any sort of future preterism, the future millennium. The preterist simply believes that history is going to go on until just Christ comes back and the eternal kingdom starts. That's a very minor view in history, seeing the return of Christ as one that's already occurred. There are a few partial preterists around who believe that Christ has not yet returned, but many of the prophecies were in fact fulfilled in the first century with the destruction of the temple. The second view then, or the other views I should say, all revolve around the millennium itself. And we began with a discussion of something called premillennialism. Now, premillennialism is far and away the most popular of all the eschatological systems. It's embraced by almost all Baptists in the West, for example. But premillennialism actually has two different forms. There's a form of premillennialism called dispensationalism, and then there's a form which is called classical or historic premillennialism. Now, dispensational premillennialism was described very thoroughly by Brian Roden in our last session together. And that was quite some time ago. But what he did very thoroughly and very effectively, I thought, was to give an overview of the flow of history as it's understood by dispensationalists, what he would call the unifying principles associated with the periods of time in the history, the dispensations of time throughout history, which would ultimately lead to the final dispensation, which is the millennium, the seventh dispensation in a seven dispensationalist system, the final dispensation. Okay, so he gave us an overview of that. But what he was unable to do, unfortunately, was to finish the thought. And this is not his fault per se. He really was hoping for a second opportunity, which never came, of course. But the idea was to have an opportunity to talk about the connection of the return of Christ to the millennium as it is understood by dispensationalists. Because there are a number of events that occur around the coming of Christ that make up the beginning of the millennial kingdom. In other words, there's a number of events that dispensationalists glean from Scripture that they place as a part of the start of the millennium. And so what I want to do in this session is to share with you some of those events. Okay. Now, let me just put a caveat here. It is not my intention to give a thorough and complete examination of all of these details in the dispensational system. Brian was unable to give a full and complete and thorough understanding of every aspect of dispensationalism himself. He had to pass over a lot of his information because it is a deep and rich system of thought. And so I'm not going to be able to do the same either. I'm not going to be able to give you a complete analysis of all of these things. But I want to touch on them and at least talk about them a little, because many of them you have probably heard. You have heard of. And in fact, some of you may even believe some of these things and expect some of these events to take place. And so it would be appropriate for us to, at least in this grand theology study that we're doing, to at least have discussed these various things, at least to some extent in this time, okay? So that's what I want to do. Now, before I start talking about them in particular, let me just say that it is difficult to know if the various things I'm about to talk about are inherent to dispensationalism itself, or if they evolved into dispensationalism from outside sources. Because the things we're going to talk about here are events that are basically unique in themselves. They don't have to be necessarily associated with dispensationalism. Dispensationalism is about how the flow of history goes through these seven different dispensations. But a lot of dispensationalists spend a lot of time talking about these things that are yet to come. And so what's always sort of troubled me in my studies of dispensationalism is are these things specific to that eschatological system, or are they sort of evolved in? And I had a conversation with Brian about it earlier this week, and I think we came to the conclusion that they are sort of evolved in, and that they have now become a part of popular dispensationalistic thinking. In other words, it's very possible that dispensationalism prior to the 19th century understood the concepts of the various dispensations and the various ruling principles as Brian laid them out, but may not have been so dogmatic about the various things we're going to talk about now. These things we're about to talk about probably came into the thinking of dispensationalism over time. Let me give you an example that'll help. You know, the state of Israel as we know it began in 1947. So there was no national Israel as a state, as a literal nation prior to 1947. You know, unless you want to go back to the 6th century or 7th century BC, back in the days of the northern and southern kingdoms of Israel. There hasn't been a national Israel since then. So much of dispensational thinking in regards to the effect of eschatology upon Israel clearly would evolve after 1947. Because now a dispensationalist would come and say, there's a national state of Israel. See, God has established a people. The promises that are promised to Israel are going to come to them. The first step of it is they have a national place they can call their own. And so they would begin to evolve an eschatological position from this view, from this event taking place in 1947. Okay. So what I'm about to talk about, the various events that I'm going to talk about, I think have to a very large extent evolved into dispensationalism over time. I remember in the 1990s watching Jack Van Impe Presents, and he was, of course, a strong dispensationalist, only died a few months ago, maybe 6 months ago, I remember. But he used to have a TV program called Jack Van Impe Presents, in which he would talk about various world events taking place, and he would line them up with the various prophecies of the events we're about to talk about. So I think that while these things are true for dispensationalists today, they've not always necessarily been a part of dispensationalism in the way that they appear in the church today. All right, so let's talk about what these things are. And the first of them is something called the rapture. The rapture. Okay. Now, the rapture is taken from a word in 1 Thessalonians 4:17, a Greek word, harpazo. And that word means something to the effect of catching up or snatching up or snatching away. And Paul seems to speak of believers being snatched away to meet Jesus in the air. Remember that phrase, in the air. And so many dispensationalists see this as a snatching away of believers to meet the Lord in the air. They see it as a specific event designed to remove believers from the world, and more particularly from a time of tribulation upon the earth, either fully or partially. Now, I'll come back and explain what I mean more about that in a moment. But the rapture is specifically seen in dispensational circles as a very specific event. In fact, for many dispensationalists, this is the next event to take place in the history of the world. The rapture is the next event. Remember back when we talked about the return of Christ being imminent, most Reformed people do not see, non-dispensationalists, to put it that way, do not see the return of Christ as imminent because there are things yet to be done. But dispensationalists in general do in fact see the return of Christ as imminent because they believe the rapture is the next thing. It is the next milestone. In fact, they would probably call it a tentpole on the spectrum of human history. You remember that the Left Behind series that came out I don't know how long it's been now, 20 years, 30 years ago. The entire series of books and movies that came out from that begin in the first volume with this event. The rapture comes. All of the believers that are living upon the earth are snatched away. And the world is left with just those people who are, as the title goes, left behind. And so the whole series is really about what happens amongst the people of the earth after the rapture, but before the return of Christ. Now, the rapture itself is debated amongst dispensationalists as to exactly when it will occur in relation to the second event. And for many dispensationalists, the second event that I'm about to talk about is really the first. It's called the Great Tribulation. The Great Tribulation. Now, if you look in Matthew chapter 24 particularly, Jesus speaks of a time of great tribulation coming upon the earth. He speaks about it starting in basically verse 3, actually verse 4. See that no one leads you astray, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not alarmed, for this must take place. The end is not yet, for nation will rise against nation, etc., as the beginning of birth pains. In verse 9, then in particular, then they will deliver you up to tribulation. That's where the word comes from. The great tribulation is seen in dispensational circles as a specific period of time, a specific time of worldwide hardship, worldwide disasters, earthquakes, pandemics like the one we're experiencing, only far worse, with a far higher mortality rate, famine, war, as we mentioned, wars and rumors of wars, pain and suffering, all kinds of things affecting the entire world, infecting the entire creation, and of course preceding the coming of Christ. There have been some dispensationalist authors that I have read, some dispensationalist preachers that I have heard in recent days who have attributed this pandemic that we are experiencing as a part of the tribulation, or maybe even sort of an introduction to the tribulation, maybe not being a part of the great tribulation, but certainly an anticipation of it coming. As I said, it's found in Matthew 24, verses 3 through 28, and it is a seven-year period that's based on Daniel 9 and Revelation 11, 3. There's some math that's done from the prophecies of those two passages of a time, and a time and a half. A three-and-a-half-year period doubled in length. So a three-and-a-half-year period, which leads to a midpoint, and then another three-and-a-half-year period, resulting in a total time of 7 years of time. Now, for dispensationalists, this seven-year period of time is critical. In fact, the Left Behind series is pretty much all about the Great Tribulation and what's taking place during this 7.5 years. One of the things that will happen in this period of time, is believed, is the reconstruction of the temple in Jerusalem by the Jews. The current Temple Mount that's occupied by the Muslims, who have a mosque on that site, will eventually be rebuilt with a temple. Now, there's some who believe the temple is actually in a different place than that, but nonetheless, there's in dispensationalism a belief that the temple will be reconstructed, that what God will do is gather his people together, the Jews, and they will rebuild their temple and, I assume, re-begin the sacrifices in that temple. Additionally, during this time will come the rise of an individual known as the Antichrist. You remember John in his epistles, 1st and 2nd John, speaks of this Antichrist. And dispensationalists see it as an actual individual. Jesus calls him in Matthew 24, verse 15, the abomination of desolation, spoken of by the prophet Daniel, standing in the holy place. And Matthew puts a little parenthesis there, let the reader beware, let the reader understand, meaning an individual who rises up at this time. He's also called the man of lawlessness in Revelation 16, 13 and 19, 20. And in Revelation 13, 1 to 10, he is described as the beast who then comes and stands in the holy place, which is believed to be in the temple. So during this seven-year period of time, it is believed that this man of lawlessness will rise up and he will, as the Antichrist, come into the temple, desecrating it by standing in it and demanding that the world worship him. He will establish himself in some way across a swath of humanity who will embrace him as their quote-unquote savior. He will do some sort of miraculous work along with another man called the false prophet who will come with him. And they will do something extraordinary that will cause the world, the peoples of the world, to flock to his side. Now, let me note that those who believe that the rapture, well, hang on to that thought for a second. This is believed to be, by dispensationalists, the literal incarnation of evil. That this represents the final rise of Satan, who incarnates evil into an individual. I'm not sure that dispensationalists consider this to be Satan himself in human form. I don't think so. I think they consider that to be the dragon spoken of in Revelation 13. He being the dragon, the ancient dragon, who then raises up a man, an individual, who comes to be the incarnation of evil himself. If you've ever seen The Omen, the movie The Omen, it's about the birth and young childhood of this individual who rises up to become this Antichrist. He is the antithesis of Christ himself, where Christ comes to bring grace and mercy and forgiveness and the love of God. This individual comes to bring rebellion and hatred against God. The final act, if you will, of Satan to attempt to deceive the nations of the world by raising up an individual, a specific individual, who will rise up and lead the nations astray, leading them away from this Christ, leading them as the anti-Christ, against the Christ. This particular individual will have something which is referred to in Revelation 14:9 as the mark of the beast. That will be a particular mark upon him in some way. Some call it the number 666 or something to that effect. And that's how it's interpreted numerologically speaking out of those passages in Revelation. And all of those who will follow this beast will have some sort of mark placed upon them. There have been all kinds of attempts through the years to identify this so-called mark. When the Social Security Administration first began issuing Social Security numbers, there were many who called it the mark of the beast. And those in the tribulation time who refuse to have this mark placed upon them are opposed, persecuted, and even martyred, some of whom are seen in later chapters of the book of Revelation crying out from under the altar, demanding their blood to be avenged by God. So there's this man who rises up in the midst of this great period of tribulation. And as I said a little bit ago, the rapture is associated with this time of tribulation. There are some, I should say most, dispensationalists who believe that the rapture actually is what starts the Great Tribulation, that Christ comes and he raptures his church out of the world. All of the true followers of Christ throughout the world are taken out before this Great Tribulation is come. And the justification that some will make is the passage to talk about the church not going through or not passing through tribulation. That the church does not have to endure this, that the church is taken away. And they would argue that the reason why the Great Tribulation is able to take place in the world is because the influence of the Spirit of God is removed. I mean, you think about it, if you take out all of the Christians in the world who possess the Spirit of God in them, then the restraining effect of the Spirit of God through them, the restraining effect of the church, the restraining effect of the preaching of the gospel, and the involvement of Christians in society and culture and politics, implies now that there is no restraint, and so evil can just flourish. So now you can have tribulation. You can have the rise of an individual who will take many to himself because there's nothing to stop him, if you will, by virtue of the church being gone. Now, let me just point out that dispensationalists do agree and believe that there will be many who will, in fact, come to faith in Christ during the Great Tribulation. And many of them, as I said earlier, will be persecuted and opposed for the refusal to embrace the Antichrist. But most dispensationalists believe that the rapture is what begins the Great Tribulation. But there are some who believe that the rapture will actually take place at the midpoint of the tribulation, at the 3.5 year point, just as the Antichrist rises to power and comes to seat himself in the temple and to establish himself over the earth. There are many who believe that it's at this point that the church will actually be raptured away. Now that evil has taken up residency, if you will, in the world, it's at this point that the Christian church is removed. Now, they're a minority of dispensationalists, but there are some out there. Brian knows of some that he has interacted with in the past. And then there's a very, very small minority of dispensationalists who believe that the rapture will occur at the end of the Great Tribulation, that in point of fact, the church will have to pass through the entirety of the tribulation, and they will only be raptured when Christ comes to overthrow the Antichrist. They will rise to meet him in the air as he is coming to bring down this Antichrist. And they would point to passages like Matthew 24:9, when Jesus says, "Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake." They would point to passages like that and say, see, the church does have to go through the tribulation. It has to go through times of great pain and suffering, as Jesus outlines it in this prophetic passage. So the rapture and the tribulation are the two great events then that rise up during this. The Great Tribulation and the rapture are the two great events that are the beginning, if you will, of the return of Christ. But then that leads to the Battle of Armageddon. Dispensationalists see the ending of the tribulation as a great gathering of the armies of the Antichrist at Megiddo to come against the forces of good. Now, it is typically against the forces of Israel. You look at Revelation 16:16, and it talks about a final revolt of the reprobate under the direction of Satan and his Antichrist against the forces of Israel with the destruction of Jerusalem. It's a great battle that occurs between the Jews who are faithful to Yahweh and the Antichrist who has come to set himself up as the ruler of the earth. And the Jews who refuse to bow down to him now come against him at Megiddo in this Battle of Armageddon. Dwight Pentecost, who was a significant voice of dispensationalism in the 20th century, considered the Battle of Armageddon to be more than just a single battle, but rather a campaign that lasts for the full 3.5 years of the second half of the tribulation. He argued that it wasn't just a battle, but based on his interpretation of many of these scriptures, many of these prophecies in scripture, that it was actually a great long campaign that starts when the Antichrist comes to exalt himself in the temple and doesn't really end until Christ actually defeats him with the forces of good and overthrows him at the end of this campaign, which, of course, is when Christ returns. So you start with the rapture. For most dispensationalists, you start with the rapture, which begins the Great Tribulation, a 7-year period of great tribulation upon the earth, the rise of the man of lawlessness and his mark, along with his false prophet, all being led by the ancient dragon, Satan, to raise up a period of tremendous moral and physical evil upon the earth. You could almost say that this is the outpouring of the wrath of God upon the earth to shake the earth and to establish wrath in it over against evil, which then leads to a final conflict between Satan and his forces and the forces of Christ. Remember, the elect coming with Christ from the rapture, coming back to earth with him, joining forces with him and overthrowing Satan, his Antichrist, and his forces, which then leads to Revelation 20, where Satan is bound for 1,000 years, cast into the pit. The Antichrist and the false prophet are also cast into the pit or cast into the lake of fire, and the end comes. The judgments then arise. Okay, now, I put all of that in front of you so you have some of that. There's many, many more details. You can find large graphs of details of all of these events that have been drawn by dispensationalists through the years. So you can find them online, and they're very detailed of when the events occur and which passages of Scripture apply to each prophecy and so forth. And I have just skimmed the surface of it. I hope I've done it fairly, but I may not have done it perfectly because, well, some of these things have changed, and my recollection of them is what I've given to you. But nonetheless, there's a lot more to it. So if you are interested in studying more of it, I would encourage you to go online and search for various aspects that I've just talked about. So the first major type of premillennialism is dispensationalism. It has a long-term view of human history as a series of dispensations, with one final dispensation, the millennium, being begun by a rapture, a tribulation, a battle of Armageddon, and ultimately the return of Christ. And as Christ comes, then he establishes this time of peace and prosperity upon the earth. Okay, that's one form of premillennialism, but there is a second. So I want to use the rest of my time in this session to talk about a second form of premillennialism, which, as I said earlier, was called classical or historic premillennialism. Now, Chiasm, C-H-I-A-L-I-S-M, we talked about earlier, Chiasm, is another term for premillennialism, but it is a way of discussing premillennialism that dates back even to the very beginning of the church age. It is true that various historians and theologians back through time certainly did speak of various dispensations. I mean, yes, Brian is correct in that Clement and Augustine and others like him spoke of dispensations. And it's true that there were some primitive forms of dispensationalism going back even to the first and second century. But to be honest, most of those views of dispensationalism were typically more of seeing church history through the lens of time periods, not necessarily dispensations of God's rule and tests of man as we see it in the modern view. The view that Brian gave to you, in all fairness, is much more common to the modern age than it was to ancient ages. I think there's been much added to dispensationalism over time that would not have been present in an ancient form of dispensationalism going way back to the beginning. But a form of premillennialism did in fact exist, going all the way back to many others, going back a long ways back. So the premillennial view, did in fact start in the second century. Premillennialism has always existed in some form in the church. There has always been some form of an interpretation of Revelation 20 to be literal in the sense that there is, in fact, a time coming of a time of prosperity upon the earth, which is preceded by the return of Christ. I mean, you can go back to some of the very earliest writers in church history. I'll bring one up in a minute that will speak of the return of Christ ushering in a day of global prosperity and global peace. Those writings have been going on for a very long time. So there's been a form of Chiasm or premillennialism going way back to the very beginning. Now, I will accept that there has been forms of dispensationalism going back to the very beginning as well, but I think it's probably fairer to say that there was a form of premillennialism that predates what we would call modern dispensationalism going back even into the second century. Now, this form of premillennialism is less of a unifying principle of history, like what Brian laid out in dispensationalism, and more of an embrace of premillennialism within the various strands of historical interpretation. In other words, there's a divorce in historic premillennialism between all the various ways that history flows itself out and the fact that Christ is going to come back and establish a kingdom in the future. True, eschatology is, generally speaking, a flow of understanding of history that leads you to the end of understanding of history, how it ends. But ancient Kielism, ancient premillennialism, did have an ability to embrace a wide swath of historic interpretations while at the same time accepting that Christ was going to return and establish a millennium. You can go back to some of the earliest church fathers and you can read this to be the case. Let me give you an example. For many Reformed people, it is possible to embrace a premillennial interpretation of history while at the same time accepting a covenantal view of the strands of history itself. You don't have to be a dispensationalist, in other words, to embrace the idea that there is a day when Christ will return and establish on earth a day of prosperity. You can embrace a covenantal view. Now, I realize, as Brian rightly pointed out, dispensationalists disagree with that particular view of history. Okay, good for them. But covenant theologians come along and say, well, we disagree with your view of the dispensational view of history, but we still embrace the idea that Christ is coming back and there will be a millennium. In other words, many of these Reformed theologians are quite willing to say, we'll take Revelation 20 literally. We'll believe that there is a literal day of prosperity coming and that Christ is going to come before it. But we're also going to understand the world through a covenant lens. And I think a historic premillennialism tries to embrace or tries, I think, to keep one foot in a more Reformed view and another view and another in a premillennial view. Okay. Now, not all Reformed people do that, as we'll see as we move along. As I said, it's a way of embracing the literalness of Revelation 20 without embracing all of the nuances of dispensationalism leading up to the return of Christ. Or I could say it another way. It's a simple acceptance of the kingdom of God upon the earth, as spoken of by Jesus frequently, without having to formulate an entire unifying principle of history to get there. So the historic premillennialist says, I don't really know how all of the flow of history works in terms of all the details working together and this dispensation versus this and so forth. I simply accept that there's a covenant that was established with Adam and there's a covenant established with Christ. And so I believe that, at least at a minimum, but I also accept that Christ is coming back and that there will be a day of prosperity upon the earth. So in other words, historic premillennialism eschews from dispensationalism all of its little nuances, including ideas of raptures and tribulations and those sorts of things. It's possible those may be true, the classic premillennialist says, but they don't have to be for the historic premillennialist. Now, like all other eschatological systems, the actual content of a historical premillennialism will vary depending on the individual and tradition behind it. I'll give you one example. Okay, let's go back to the second century AD to a man by Irenaeus, a man named Irenaeus. He lived from 130, from about 130 to 202 AD. So we're near the end. He lived in the second half of the second century AD. And he wrote that he believed that the world would endure 6,000 years of time, okay, the 6 days of creation, the sufferings of the pious increasing until the incarnation of evil itself in the Antichrist, who would seat himself in the temple, who would then be overthrown by the return of Christ, to be followed by the resurrection and the establishment of the millennial kingdom. Now, you might look at that and say, well, that sounds very much like a dispensational view, but it's very general in the sense that it doesn't really possess all of the nuances of what is contained in modern dispensational thought. John Hagee, Jack Van Impe, and others like him would have a very distinct set of details relating to those basic mileposts that Irenaeus would not necessarily have had. Now, fundamentally, this form of Kielism remained consistent up to the modern age, that there has been a version of historic premillennialism in this fashion, this basic, simplistic fashion, going right through the Middle Ages, right through the days of the Reformation, and even up to the modern age. There's been a form of this sort of premillennialism. Dispensationalism flourished, I think, and this is just my personal opinion, but I think that dispensationalism flourished in the 20th century because of the advent of so much evil in the world in the 20th century. Remember, 100 million people died in the 20th century as a direct or indirect result of war. And you think of the number of evil characters like Hitler and Pol Pot and Stalin and others like him, Mussolini, etc. All of these kinds of evil people who arose and created massive scourges upon the land, and it gave dispensationalists some fertile ground to work in terms of the rise of the Antichrist, in terms of details relating to those things. So it is possible in the modern age to see a break, a strong break, I think, between the dispensational view that has now become very popularized by books like Left Behind, and the more historic premillennialism that sort of sees a more generalized set of things taking place, not trying to fit, if you will, every prophecy into every event that takes place in time and space. Now, I would agree that in the 19th to 20th centuries, classical premillennialism has evolved to declare a number of significant events to occur. I mean, you think about the evangelization of the nations, the conversion of Israel, the great apostasy and tribulation, the rise of the man of sin. Much of the things that occurred in the 19th and 20th centuries would certainly impact the thinking of the historic premillennialist. But generally speaking, historic premillennialists have a tendency to sort of push away from the table when it comes to trying to take all of those little details and fit them into a certain place in the timeline. Dispensationalists, with all due respect, dispensationalists that I have met through time very much like to do that. I remember the number of dispensationalists that I grew up around, as I said, back in the 90s, who had their graphs and their charts, and they could lay out for you exactly when various things were going to occur. In fact, there was books written about, 88 reasons why Christ will return in 88, or I don't know if that's the exact title, but something like that. Why we know, and these are all the events that prove that it's going to happen in this particular year, or those who stood up and said, yes, the 10-headed beast that's coming up out of the sea, that's the EU with the 10 nations that are coming up. And of course, the problem is that many of those details have not really fleshed themselves out very well in actual time and space, because the EU is no longer a 10-member nation, right? There's a lot more than 10 nations in the EU. So the classical premillennialist says, well, look, I accept that there is a time when Christ is going to return and establish a day of prosperity upon the earth, but I'm not so concerned with all of the details of how that is rising to its crescendo at the end. In fact, I think the classical premillennialist of the modern day would more likely say something like this. Look, let's assume that Christ is going to come back and establish a kingdom upon the earth. I'll give you that. But here's what's much more important. Now, What's much more important now is us going out and evangelizing the world. It's us going out and preaching the gospel to all the nations. It's us going out and living the Great Commission. Sure, we want Jesus to come back, and we would love for a rapture to take place tomorrow, but let's put all of that future stuff aside for a moment, and let's get busy doing what we're doing now. I think it's a fair accusation that classical premillennialists could make against dispensationalists to say that many dispensationalists are so future-focused that they're no good in the present. Now, again, that's a gross generalization, and I mean no offense by it to any particular dispensationalist. But the fact is that dispensationalists have, unfortunately, and they would probably admit this, focused on prophecy conferences and prophecy timelines and these sorts of things. And their focus is so much to the future that many of the churches that are dispensational in their eschatology are not effective in their evangelization. Could it be that one of the reasons why so many churches do not actually do any significant evangelism is because they're more focused on the future? Now, I don't want that to sound like some sort of indictment of the church. There's a lot of reasons why the church is failing to do her work in the world the way that they're supposed to. But the classical premillennialists would come along and say, maybe that's one of the reasons why we should sort of avoid all that detail and just get down to the business of doing what Christ has commanded us to do. Let's be ready, doing what it is that Christ has commanded us to do, because he's eventually going to come back. Like a thief in the night, he's going to return, and we better be found doing what we're supposed to be doing. Okay, now, we can argue the points between dispensationalism and standard keelism all we want to. We've been doing this for a very long time, so it's not my intention here, as I said, to promote one side or the other, but to simply give you an overview of these two major forms of premillennialism. It's entirely up to you to decide which one you want to believe, or maybe even come up with a novel third one that nobody has even thought about. I don't know. But the point is that now we have an understanding of the first of the major views of the millennium, the belief that there will be a literal thousand-year period of peace and prosperity upon the earth, governed by the personal return of Christ upon the earth, his personal appearance and governance here upon the earth, and that it will be a time that all of us as the elect look forward to. Okay, that's what the premillennialist is looking for. But there are other views of the millennium, and in our next session, we will talk about them. And so may the Lord grant you wisdom as you consider these things, and I pray that you will find them useful in your study of the things of God. Peace be upon your house.